the public goes to the Department of Motor Vehicles and they're asked, do you want to be an organ donor? And they look at the brightly colored posters that say, you know, give the gift of life, be a good citizen. And they're being asked to make probably one of the biggest medical decisions of their life by someone at the DMV without any type of information.
Welcome to Straight Talk on Life Issues. It's always great to have you with us. I'm Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute. And let me tell you, this is a program, a two-part program you will never forget.
That's right. And I'm your co-host, Victor Nieves. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Victor, imagine you're lying in a hospital bed, unable to communicate. You can hear everything going on around you, but you can't move or talk, even the slightest. And then you hear the doctor say, you're brain dead.
It's an absolute nightmare to think about. And while most people presume that organs can only be removed or transplanted after all efforts to save the donor's life have been exhausted, organ donation has changed.
Oh, changed is an understatement. Now a person who's brain injured and considered close to death, but doesn't necessarily meet the criteria for brain death, still may qualify as an organ donor.
And for organs to be viable, the patient has to be breathing. The heart must be pumping. The harvest can't wait for death as the public perceives death. Let's jump into this conversation today with our guest, Dr. Heidi Klesik. She attended medical school at UW-Madison, where she completed a residency program in anesthesiology. She was a founding partner of the Pain Clinic of Northwestern Wisconsin and an instructor for the International Spinal Injection Society. She now writes and speaks on the ethics of organ donation and transplantation.
Well, Dr. Klesik, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
This is a very interesting topic that I'm sure many of our listeners have probably never thought of. So first of all, I'd like to ask, is organ donation today ethical, or are lines being crossed in zeal to harvest those organs in short supply?
You know, organ donation is a big subject, and there are ways to do it ethically. But by and large, what's going on is the public is being not informed about what actually is happening behind the operating room doors. People who have been given diagnoses like brain death are being removed from ventilators and used as organ donors while they are still alive. Brain death has never had any scientific basis. It's a ethical choice masquerading as a medical fact.
Well, before we leave that topic, let's get into the diagnosis of brain death. Why is it that you are not fond of that?
Well, I'll tell you, it sort of blindsided me. I'll tell you how I learned about this myself. When I was an anesthesiology resident studying to become an anesthesiologist, I came in for night call one night and reported for duty. And they said, Klesik, glad you're here. We have a brain dead man up in ICU and we want you to come and take him down for an organ harvesting. And I was a little stunned. I sort of remembered that I had heard a lecture about brain death somewhere along the line, but I didn't have all the facts right at my fingertips. So I said to the doctor, oh, brain death, huh? Well, is there anything different about this I need to know? And he kind of laughed and he rolled his eyes and said, just be sure someone has declared him brain dead. You know how eager the transplant team can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that wasn't very reassuring. So I went up to see my patient. And you know, when I saw him in the ICU, he looked like every other ICU patient I had taken care of. And in fact, better than most. He was a young man about my own age. He had a motorcycle accident. He had a severe brain injury. And yes, the neurologist had declared him to be brain dead. But when I went to look at him, he was warm. He was breathing with the help of a ventilator. He had an excellent heart rate and blood pressure. He had almost 100% oxygen saturation in his blood. His skin was warm and supple. He was making urine. I mean, he did not look dead. So I went back down to the operating room and I found the anesthesiologist who was going to be supervising me for the case. And I presented it to him. And he said, all right, what's your anesthetic plan of care? Well, you know, I was so brainwashed at the time. I mean, they told me the man was dead. And so despite the evidence of my eyes, I believed my authorities. So I said, well, I think I'll use a paralyzing agent so he doesn't move during the surgery, right? Now think about that. Why should we have to worry about a dead person moving? But I was in a state of cognitive dissonance, I guess, at the time. So I said, I'm going to use a paralyzing agent because, you know, surgeons get kind of crabby when people are moving and they're trying to operate. And then I think I'll give him some fentanyl as a powerful painkiller to blunt any heart rate or blood pressure responses that might damage his organs. So my attending looked at me and he said, well, are you going to give a drug to block consciousness? I was a little stunned by that. I said, why would I do that? Isn't he dead? And he just gave me a long, slow look over his surgical mask. And he said, why don't you give one just in case? And he walked away. Well, I'll tell you, you know, to my shame and regret, I did what I was told. I mean, I knew something was wrong about this, but all my authorities were telling me this is the way we do it. This is how it's done. The operating room team was scrubbed and ready to go. And I just should have put up more of a fuss, but I did what I was told. I took him to the operating room. I gave him the anesthetic we had discussed. He reacted just like any other patient to the incisions and the bone saws and the organ removal. He required the same types and amounts of anesthesia as anyone else. And honestly, it's my regret over this incident that motivates me now to be speaking to you today and to have a website and to write a book and to try to inform the public. I see my role as giving the public a seat at the table, because when I came to research this for myself, I was stunned to find that for 50, 60 years, doctors, lawyers, philosophers, PhDs have been hotly debating whether brain death is death, whether donation after circulatory death donors are actually dead at the time their organs are procured. The ethics of this new form of transplant called normothermic regional perfusion, or NRP. But the public is never told. I mean, the public goes to the Department of Motor Vehicles and they're asked, do you want to be an organ donor? And they look at the brightly colored posters that say, you know, give the gift of life, be a good citizen, be altruistic. And they're never given any informed consent. They're not told any of the details or the facts. And they're being asked to make probably one of the biggest medical decisions of their life by someone at the DMV without any type of information. And I think that's wrong. So that's what I'm trying to do, is raise awareness for people so they can make an informed decision.
Well, isn't the definition or diagnosis of brain death a solid medical factual diagnosis?
Well, funny you should say that. You know, the most recent American Academy of Neurology brain death guideline that just came out in 2023, in their methods section, they come right out and say, because of the lack of high quality evidence on the subject, this is a consensus guideline determined by essentially three rounds of anonymous voting. By panelists who are screened to screen out anybody who might disagree. So absolutely not. I mean, the brain death was started back in 1968. I mean, honestly, all through history, you really didn't need a doctor to tell you when someone was dead. I mean, people determined death at home, on the battlefield, at the farm. You could tell when someone is dead, right? Most people understand death to be the separation of the spirit or the soul or the life principle from the material body. But because we don't have any instruments for detecting immaterial changes, we go with the loss of heartbeat, the loss of breathing, and the passage of time. And that's how people have determined death for millennia. But in 1968, 13 men at Harvard Medical School put out a landmark article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's titled A Definition of Irreversible Coma. So these men thought, we could change the definition and call people who have previously always been believed to be alive, people who are in a coma that doctors think is probably irreversible, as now being somehow dead already. Now, this paper, it has no scientific references. There were no tests. There were no studies. There is no evidence that these people in a coma are dead. The only reason they said that maybe we should give them this new diagnosis was utility. They said if we could call these people on a ventilator dead already, it will serve to free up ICU beds and it will remove the controversy of procuring these people's organs to put into somebody else. And so for all of its history, there really has not been any scientific evidence for it. But what is really useful about redefining people morally, ethically, and legally as being dead, even though they have beating hearts, they're metabolizing, they're making urine, they can even deliver healthy babies. If you define someone as being dead, then you, by sleight of hand, you meet the requirements of what's called the dead donor rule. Now, the dead donor rule is not a law, but it's a worldwide ethical maxim. It says people must neither be alive when organs are removed, nor may they be killed by the process of organ removal. But if you redefine people as being dead already, this allows organ procurement to skirt the dead donor rule just by fiat, by sleight of hand.
So, Dr. Klesig, it's fair to say from what you've said today that what we as lay people think of when we hear the phrase dead is not what the medical establishment is using when they procure people's organs.
That's correct. You know, when most people hear the word dead, they think dead in the sense of, you know, my dead pet cat or dog, right? The dead in the way that, you know, a squirrel on the highway is dead. But when doctors are talking about this brain death thing, the legal standard that has been set up for that is called the Uniform Determination of Death Act, and that is in force in almost all 50 states. It says that to have a diagnosis of brain death, there must be the irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem. But honestly, no American Academy of Neurology brain death guideline has ever followed the law on that. They don't test, in fact, all functions of the entire brain. They test that you're in a coma. They test a handful of brainstem reflexes, and they test whether you breathe when disconnected from your ventilator. So, in fact, the way doctors diagnose, according to the protocol, does not follow the legal standard.
Can you explain the process that surgeons use to harvest organs?
First, they need to get someone to make this diagnosis. And so they follow a specific protocol that you have to be unresponsive, right? When they call your name or shake you, you don't respond. But now remember, unresponsiveness is not the same as unawareness. There are people who are inwardly aware, sort of locked in within themselves, but unable to respond. A recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine found 25% of people who doctors thought were unconscious actually were inwardly aware. So doctors are not tremendously good at discovering whether you're inwardly aware or not. We can only test whether you're able and willing to respond. Then they give a painful stimulus to see if you move. And if you move to the painful stimulus, they say, well, then you're not brain dead. But the guideline says that it can sometimes be challenging to determine whether a patient's movement is just a reflex or if it's intentional. And they actually go on to tell doctors using this protocol, if you're not sure if your moving patient is still alive, you should ask a friend. They say, ask a colleague and then kind of put your heads together and decide. I mean, how scientific is that? Then the only neurologic exam that is done, they check if your pupils respond to light, they shoot water in your ears to see if it makes your eyes dizzy. They check if you cough or gag. These are not all the functions of the entire brain, okay? I mean, honestly, our brains do a lot more than that, but that's all they test. And then the apnea test is where they take you off your ventilator for 10 to 15 minutes to see if you breathe. And they give parameters, you know, for your blood gas, what it should be with that. But the guideline actually goes on to say that selection of targets for the apnea test is arbitrary, because there is no scientific data demonstrating at what point you would breathe if your brain was working when you have a brain injury. So the whole diagnosis is incorrect. But then, you know, when someone like me takes that person to the operating room, we give them anesthesia just like anyone else. We give them a paralyzing agent so they won't move. We use narcotic drugs to blunt the responses to pain that they will have. I can tell you from personal experience, when there's an incision, the heart rate and the blood pressure go up just like anybody else. The surgeons then go ahead and cool off and chill down a lot of the organs that are going to be taken out for preservation. And then they go for the organs that they're having targeted, depending on the technique that's being used.
Well, now the average person, I think, who signs those donor cards believes that the person dies, the heart stops beating, the family takes a few moments to say their goodbyes, the dead body is wheeled in a nearby room, and then they harvest the organs. Is that what happens?
So there's a type of organ donation called donation after circulatory death. And these people are not brain dead, but they're not expected to survive, or they have decided that their quality of life is unacceptable and they want to have their care withdrawn in a way that will allow their organs to be procured. So their death is essentially planned to happen in a specific time and place. This is really a thinly veiled form of physician-assisted death. So these people often have large catheters put in their groin, and they're given drugs like blood thinners, heparin, to preserve the organs, things that actually aren't very good for the patient. They have to make these people do not resuscitate, or DNR. So again, this is a choice. All of these people could be resuscitated, but a decision has been made not to resuscitate them. So then they are taken to the operating room nearby. Their ventilator is disconnected and their medical support is withdrawn. And then doctors wait for them to die, wait for their heart to stop. I mean, it's really fairly ghoulish. And instead of dying in the arms of your family, love surrounding you, you're taken down to the operating room with gloved gown and masked strangers who are sitting there waiting for you to pass away so they can begin, removing parts of you. After your heart stops, doctors give a 2 to 5 minute no touch or wait period to be sure your heart doesn't restart. I mean, it depends on where you live. In my state of Wisconsin, it's 2 minutes. In other states, it's 5 minutes. Whether you're dead or alive is based kind of on your geography more than anything else. And then if your heart doesn't spontaneously restart, they declare you dead and they begin the organ procurement. But the problem with this is that it's well documented. I mean, in fact, everybody knows that people are routinely resuscitated after 2 to 5 minutes of cardiac arrest. And if you could still be resuscitated, you were never dead. And other countries, understand this. This donation after circulatory death is banned in Finland, Germany, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Hungary, Lithuania, and Turkey. So again, depending on where you live, you might be dead or alive on geography, not based on medicine. And there's a case report from my neighboring state of Illinois that bears this out. A young woman with Down syndrome in Illinois suffered a brain bleed. And she wasn't brain dead, but her family was told she wasn't expected to survive, and they were told they could make something good come out of their tragedy and consented to have her organs procured using this donation after circulatory death protocol. So this unfortunate young woman was taken to the operating room and her care was withdrawn. Once her heart stopped, the physician reached up under the sterile drapes and listened to her heart for an additional 2 minutes and didn't hear any heartbeat. So then they began to operate to get her kidneys. But as doctors got into her abdomen and were cutting down to her kidneys, they noticed suddenly that there were pulses in the aorta and the renal arteries, and the young woman began to gasp for breath. Oh, well, I mean, now what do you do, right? Here we are. So out of pure compassion, they gave her a massive overdose of fentanyl and lorazepam, and the pulses stopped and she stopped breathing, and she was subsequently pronounced dead a second time. But, when the medical examiner looked at this case, I mean, he had to say this was a homicide, is what was his declaration. She had been killed by organ procurement. She was not dead after 2 minute wait time. And that's the thing. Dr. Ari Jaffe, who's a doctor in Canada, has done a literature review and found people who spontaneously resuscitated themselves after up to 10 minutes of cardiac arrest. So we know scientifically from the medical literature, at 10 minutes, you might still be able to be resuscitated. And some of the patients that he studied had made a complete recovery. So again, wow. 2 to 5 minutes is a travesty. And that's in the recent New York Times article. They had multiple cases of this type of problem. Misty Hawkins was one. They had that in the New York Times recent examination of donation after circulatory death. Misty was a similar case to what I just described, a young woman who choked while eating a sandwich and had a low oxygen brain injury, taken to the hospital, not brain dead, but her parents were told that she wasn't going to survive. And they didn't want their daughter to suffer, and they thought they could help somebody else out, so they consented to this DCD protocol. Misty was taken to the operating room, disconnected from her care. It took her 103 minutes to become pulseless. It's just like a death watch. It's horrible to think about. Once her heart stopped, I think for her, they waited the whole 5 minutes, which again is not long enough, because when doctors then took the bone saw and sawed open her breastbone, they found her heart was beating and Misty was breathing at that time too. Now, the really terrible thing, you know, the doctors walked out, left someone else to stitch her up. It's not clear if she was ever given any anesthesia, and her family was never told. The organ procurement coordinator called her mother on the phone and said, gee, we're sorry. It just didn't work out for Misty to become an organ donor. The Hawkins family only found out what happened to their daughter when the New York Times contacted them a year later for comment. What a horrible way to find out what had been done to your child. I mean, this has to stop. This is wrong.
They're putting people down like dogs.
Well, dogs get it better. I mean, dogs for sure get an anesthetic. I have anesthesia journal articles I can show you that talk about the anesthetic care of organ donors. I can show you an article that mentions how to manage their heart rate, their blood pressure, how to blunt, you know, any responses that might hurt the organs. It does not mention one word about actual anesthesia. And that's the problem. You know, many of these people may just get paralyzing drugs and drugs to manage the blood pressure and maybe awake and aware at some level as they're being dismembered to death. This could have happened to Zach Dunlap. I don't know if you remember him. He was a famous case. In 2007, Zach Dunlap was a young man who had a four-wheel ATV rollover injury. He had a severe injury. I mean, he had brain tissue coming out of his ear canal, taken to the hospital, declared to be brain dead. The helicopter was landing with the team to procure his organs, but his cousin, it wasn't his healthcare team, his cousin, who was also a nurse, didn't believe Zach was dead and ran his closed clasp knife along Zach's foot, and Zach withdrew. And so his cousin called the nurse over, come, look, my cousin's moving. But the nurse said, well, you know, they teach us in brain death school that the patient can be moving, but they're still dead. So then the cousin gave a second stimulus, and this time, you know, Zach pretty much took a swing at him, and the nurse said, oh, wait, that movement crossed the midline. That might mean he actually isn't dead. So the procedure was called off, and Zach made a full recovery. I mean, he got married. He has a little girl. He works a job. But he told people while he was lying there, he could hear every word. He said, I could hear the doctors telling my parents that I was brain dead, that I was not going to survive. And I just got mad. But there was nothing I could do. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. I couldn't sign. All I could do was get extremely angry. And this shows the gravity of these correctly made brain death diagnoses. I put correctly in scare quotes because, of course, none of these people are dead. But if you follow the protocol, supposedly it's correctly done. Zach Dunlap's case followed the protocol, but he could hear every word. Now, an anesthesiologist had taken him to the OR and just used paralyzing agents. Can you imagine the horror? We have no idea how many people are going through this. So yes. Again, this needs to stop.
I'm outraged. I just don't know what to say after you've shared this information. Thank you so much, Dr. Klesig, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, Victor, I like to think I'm very well educated and versed on this issue of organ donation. And I really am. But I'll tell you, as we listened to Dr. Klesig give example after example, I was absolutely horrified.
Oh, it's completely mortifying. And I think, Brad, to me, part of what's so horrific about it is the lack of informed consent, because you have very well-intentioned people who just want to give the gift of life, like they see at the DMV, and they're being taken advantage of.
And not only informed consent, but those so-called physicians that think MD stands for medical deity, and they are making life and death decisions in very unethical ways, and there doesn't seem to be anyone or any law to put the roadblock on.
Well, and anything that might be a roadblock seems to just be ignored. Like you said, it seems that they believe that there's some sort of a deity taking these decisions of life and death, literal life and death, into their own hands. It's been so important that we've had this opportunity to share the truth about this, because this is going to be very eye-opening for a lot of people. And to you, our listener, I want to encourage you to go to our website, lifeissues.org. There you'll find some fantastic resources. We know you're going to want to learn more about this important topic. You can find information about brain death. You can find information about the different procurement types that we've heard about today. Resources provided by Dr. Klesig, that'll be available on our website, lifeissues.org, so that you can get that information to your friends, your family members, and your church community. Be sure to tune in next week for part 2 of this important conversation.